Tonight on Standing Room Only, Nuclear Dangers.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
On October 11th, Jeff Wilson of the Plowshares Fund in Washington, D.C., spoke about the Trump administration's planned $1 trillion nuclear weapons escalation and the growing risks of war with North Korea and Iran. The Bloomington Peace Action Coalition co-sponsored the talk, alongside the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Just Peace Task Force of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Bloomington, the Bloomington Friends Meeting, and Citizens for a Just Peace in Palestine and Israel. This is the second half of the talk. If you'd like to go back and hear the beginning, it is the second half of our last episode.
This is one of my favorite scenes from Dr. Strangelove. General Turgidson here has a binder that's casualties estimated in mega deaths. And that's what we're talking about. This is a truly terrifying prospect. And it's scary stuff, but unfortunately it gets worse. Let's go to the next one. I think that most of us can agree that any of these strategic weapons that we've just been talking about are used, the game is up. You launch one of these, and you might as well launch all of them. You're talking about global thermonuclear war. We all learned this in high school. That's how mutually assured destruction works, right? We launch one, they launch them. The game is up. It's over. Strategic nuclear weapons were built and are maintained today in order to deter other nuclear states from using their weapons against us. Unfortunately, right now, there is a move within the Pentagon and the White House to make a series of smaller and, quote, more usable nuclear weapons. Why? In what sort of situations would these weapons be used? Well, according to proponents of this process, they would be used for things like this. Let's say you have a hardened bunker with a whole bunch of North Korean artillery in it that we can't assure would be taken out in this mythical military solution. Well, we'll just drop a little nuke on it. That'll solve the problem. You can't take out, that Iranian enrichment facility with 100% assurity from some of the largest bombs ever created. Well, we'll just put a little nuke on top of it. That'll fix the problem. After all, these are only small weapons, right? We're only talking about a couple hundred kilotons all the way down to 0.5 kilotons dropped by conventional aircraft. And you see, bad ideas have a nasty habit of coming back around. At the height of the Cold War, we had a nuclear weapon for every conventional combat mission. We had nuclear depth charges. We had nuclear torpedoes, nuclear landmines, nuclear artillery and battleship shells, and one of my all-time favorites, the nuclear unguided air-to-air rocket. But we even had a nuclear bazooka. This was supposed to be given to the United States Army, and they were produced. It's called the Davy Crockett. It has a 20-ton nuclear yield and was affectionately known as the IQ test in a tube because the blast radius was larger than the weapon's effective range. So if you decided that you want to set one of these off, I hope you can run really, really fast. Luckily, most of these weapons were phased out. The thing that we seem to forget is that most nuclear reductions have been done by Republicans, not Democrats. President George H.W. Bush eliminated 14,000 of these tactical nuclear weapons in 1991. He denuclearized the United States Surface Navy, all these torpedoes and depth charges that I've just been talking about. He pulled U.S. nukes out of South Korea, something now that some people are thinking about putting back. And most Americans thought that this is how the trend would continue. Like my father said, we thought that this problem was solved. Here's the thing. We still have 150 B-61 tactical nuclear bombs deployed in NATO countries in Europe and Turkey. What's the B61? Well, it kind of sounds like a vitamin, right? Sounds like something that you take at breakfast, but it's not. It's a variable, or in military jargon, a dial-a-yield nuclear weapon that can be set to explode anywhere between 0.3 and 170 kilotons, depending on the mission. And it's meant for exactly the sort of tactical situations we've been talking about. The problem is that if you start using nuclear weapons for less than deterrent missions, so less than keeping nations from nuking one another, if we decide that we want to use one on North Korea because they have a bunker that's a problem for us or something, the threshold for the use of nuclear weapons gets lowered worldwide. So if we use one on Iran, on Fordow, the enrichment processing facility, or North Korea in a pinch, what's to stop the Russians using one on Ukraine? Or India using one on Pakistan? Or China on India? Or Russia on NATO? And, well, there goes the planet, right? It's called escalation. It's what every child learned and still learns about nuclear weapons. Let's go to the next one. We got to remember what President Reagan said. A nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. Only two nuclear weapons have ever been used on this planet, and we have built and maintained tens of thousands of them in the 72 years since those first bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. If nothing else, that is a testament to their terrifying potential for destruction. We haven't stopped killing one another in that time. We haven't stopped fighting wars with one another. But even in the darkest moments of Korea, Vietnam, or even the War on Terror, has there ever been the need to use one again? Now, that doesn't mean that people haven't come up with plans to use them. In fact, there have been plans to use nuclear weapons in almost every war, up to and including Desert Storm. But to do so would have meant to have broken one of the greatest taboos in human civilization and would have threatened the use of more of them by other nations around the globe. Now, that hasn't stopped Cold Warriors from planning for their use or planning for new ones like the Davy Crockett there. As an example, I was at a debate that Plowshares helped host earlier this year with John Harvey, who was the former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Defense for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Weapons under President Barack Obama, and who now sits on the Pentagon's Defense Science Board. He said, "The 2017 Nuclear Posture Review should explore the following options: the modification of an existing warhead to provide a low-yield option for ballistic missiles, the restoral of land attack nuclear sea-launched cruise missiles to attack submarines, the restoral of nuclear weapons to aircraft carriers via the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, increased dual-capable aircraft readiness for NATO, and the possibility of demonstrating the capability to deploy dual-capable aircraft to the Republic of Korea and possibly Japan." That would be a 180-degree turn on almost three decades of U.S. tactical nuclear weapons policy. It would include the renuclearization of the surface Navy, putting nukes back into South Korea, and making a less-than-deterrent option for our ballistic missiles. These recommendations don't exist in a vacuum. In fact, almost every other nuclear power out there is embarking on dramatic new weapons programs and are upgrading their current forces to maintain parity with a resurgent U.S. nuclear arsenal. Former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry says that we were lucky to survive the last nuclear arms race, but now we're stumbling into a new one. And the truth is that the vast majority of these weapons do nothing to keep us safe. Did nuclear weapons deter terrorists from flying airplanes into the Two Towers? Have the $20 billion a year we spend on just maintaining these weapons in their silos and stockpiles done anything to combat ISIS, piracy, cyber attacks, or climate change? I don't think so. In fact, more often than not, just sitting in their silos and launch tubes, these weapons are a constant danger to us. the very citizens that they are supposed to protect. Accidents involving our nuclear arsenal are nothing new. And on a few occasions, we almost lost a state. Let's do the next one, Mike. Well, I'm going to get to that, Marge. Hold on one second. Perhaps the most famous U.S. nuclear weapons accident happened in 1961 when a B-52, this is a strategic bomber that's still in the force today, broke apart over North Carolina, releasing 2 4-megaton nuclear bombs. One of the bombs, right up there in the top left, is parachute deployed, and it fell to the ground safely, which may not fill any of you with any sort of comfort. But the other one fell all the way to Earth without its parachute. All of that weapon's safety mechanisms failed except for one. It was a single low-voltage switch, like the kind you used to be able to buy at a Radio Shack, that prevented a hydrogen bomb from destroying a good portion of North Carolina. In 1980, an airman working on a Titan II ballistic missile dropped part of a socket wrench while performing routine maintenance. Anybody that's ever been to shop class has done this before. You miss a stroke, the wrench head falls off from the handle and falls away, and you got to pick it up. Unfortunately, this one fell 70 feet and punctured the aluminum skin of the missile, which started leaking rocket fuel throughout the silo. After 8.5 hours, the fuel exploded, and the 9-megaton nuclear warhead launched into the air and landed 100 feet from the silo. Let me just give you an idea of how powerful that warhead was. It's the most powerful U.S. nuclear warhead that's ever been deployed. 9 megatons is about equal to 3 times the explosive force of all the bombs dropped during the Second World War, including the 2 atomic bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Luckily, it didn't explode, because if it had, we would have lost all of Arkansas. And so these are some of the examples here. This is the damaged house where this bomb fell with its parachute intact, and this is a giant crater from where the other bomb fell all the way to Earth, and it flattened all these trees around it. This is a Titan II missile sitting in its silo right here. This is what that Damascus silo looked like after that weapon exploded. In 2007, a B-52 flew from North Dakota to Louisiana carrying 6 nuclear warheads under its wing by mistake and in violation of a Cold War treaty not to actively fly nuclear weapons. The crew of the plane did not realize that they were carrying nuclear weapons, just as the airmen in North Dakota did not know that there were any nuclear weapons missing from their arsenal. And nobody realized that something was wrong for 36 hours. Those weapons were protected by nothing more than a chain link fence going around the tarmac. Just a year later, in 2008, the Air Force investigated a case of gross incompetence. Can you guys still hear me?
Yeah.
After a fire in a launcher equipment room went unnoticed for 5 days, it turned out that the smoke alarm battery was kaput. The Associated Press write-up of the incident sounds like a script for a low-budget slapstick comedy. It reads, "The fire was caused by a loose electrical connection on a battery charger that activated when a storm knocked out the main power source. The fire ignited a shotgun storage case, incinerated shotgun shells, ignited and melted duct tape at the opening of the launch tube, charred an umbilical cable in several places, and burned through wires in a pressure monitoring cable." Now, this report is obviously concerning for several reasons, but amongst other things, the report revealed that airmen had been using duct tape to secure wires connected to the missile. Now, duct tape might be something you use to repair the side mirror of your car just fine, but it's certainly not something that I want associated with a 335-kiloton nuclear weapon. In 2014, there was a huge outcry over a drug safety and cheating scandal that was rampant throughout our silo-based missileer force. Reports of missileers taking hard drugs while on watch, leaving silo doors open for the pizza delivery dude. I'm serious. And widespread cheating on their readiness exams should scare you, because it certainly scares me. But these incidents are only a small sample of our nuclear near misses, and we do not have a comprehensive list of nuclear accidents in this country. We do know that the Department of Defense has released narrative summaries for 32 serious accidents involving nuclear weapons between 1950 and 1980. Author Eric Schlosser, the author of the tremendous book Command and Control, which is also now a Netflix documentary, claims to have received a document via a FOIA request that details over 1,000 nuclear weapons accidents and incidents between 1950 and 1968 alone. And if we have these sorts of problems in the largest, most sophisticated, and well-funded military in the world, imagine what the Russians have to deal with. Imagine what the Pakistanis have to deal with. In 1961, President Kennedy famously warned that every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads and capable of being cut at any moment by accident, miscalculation, or madness. Today, that warning still rings true. The point here that is, if you have so many nuclear weapons that you can misplace them and don't maintain them properly, you probably have too many nuclear weapons. We must begin to reduce these nuclear arsenals before they begin to reduce us. So that's enough doom and gloom for the time being. Go ahead, Mike. Let's talk about what can be done about it. Many say that eliminating nuclear weapons is an impossible task, that you're being naive, that it's just not a realistic endeavor. But we have seen the impossible happen all the time. The United States put a man on the moon. The world watched a man walk out of a South African prison and into the South African presidency. The Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union fell. In my lifetime, I have seen Catholics and Protestants make peace in Ireland, something that my family never thought would happen. I saw the first African-American president of the United States walk into the White House, a house that was built by slaves. I've witnessed gay marriage become legal in 25 countries, and I saw the United States and Iran, two of the world's greatest self-proclaimed enemies, build a negotiated accord to settle one of the last great proliferation threats in the world. Just because something is hard doesn't mean we shouldn't work towards it. In terms of actual policy, a great place to start would be the Markey-Lew Bill, which stipulates that the President of the United States cannot use nuclear weapons first in a conflict without first getting authorization from Congress. We call this the thermonuclear monarchy, the presidency of the United States. And it's a whole other issue that I've kind of glossed over. But if the president decides to use nuclear weapons for any reason, if he decides just one day he doesn't like North Korea or Canada or Great Britain or Germany or Russia, no one can stop him from using nuclear weapons against them. Not the Congress, not the Supreme Court, not the Secretary of Defense, or even the Vice President. There is no two-man rule for the President deciding to launch nuclear weapons. There are no checks and balances, even in the world's greatest democracy, on our use of nuclear weapons. There's nothing. During the 1974 impeachment proceedings of Richard Nixon, Nixon told the press, "I don't think you understand, but I can go back into my office, pick up the telephone, and in 20 minutes, 70 million people will be dead." He was not wrong. The president is a nuclear monarch. He has the sole authority to end human civilization. That must change. For those who are asking what you yourself can do to help, please call your congressman and tell them to support this bill. They're still looking for co-sponsors. Call Senator Donnelly, call Senator Young, and Representative Hollingsworth and tell them that they should support a democratic and constitutional check on President Trump's ability to launch nuclear weapons by himself. Next, The United States should pull all of its tactical nuclear weapons out of Europe and Turkey. These weapons are an inherently destabilizing symbol of a less than deterrent nuclear force. And they are located near some of the most volatile conflict zones in the world. Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, for instance, houses some 60 U.S. B-61 bombs, those bombs that can go anywhere from 0.3 to 170 kilotons. And it's just 60 miles north from the border with war-torn Syria. For those of you who remember, in July of last year, Turkey had a coup. And jets opposing President Erdogan flew out of that base. In response, pro-Erdogan forces claimed that the U.S. had supported the coup, surrounded the base, cut off its power, and prevented U.S. servicemen from leaving. Now, you cannot tell me that that is a situation made safer by the presence of U.S. nuclear weapons. And we should be very worried about continuing to base them in NATO countries. The U.S. loses none of its deterrent effect by pulling these weapons back. It is a simple, costless move that would go to great lengths in making the world a much safer place. Next, we should end hair trigger alert. And again, this is another posture left over from the Cold War, saying that we can launch nuclear weapons within moments. This is a problem because, just like those other nuclear accidents, early warning radars and systems fail all the time. Radar picks up phantom missile signals. Training tape showing Russian first strikes are accidentally played instead of the live feeds at NORAD. Or notifications of civilian rocket launches are not communicated, and all of a sudden, launch officers have minutes to decide whether or not the missile on their radar screens is a nuke and whether or not they should fire back. This is a very, very real problem. There's a man that just passed away recently, a former Soviet launch officer, early warning detection officer, who saw 5 phantom signals on his radar screen and had moments to call the premier and say, "We need to retaliate on the United States. Here comes the nuclear attack." Luckily for him, he had a cool enough head to say, "I think if the Americans were attacking us, they would have used more than 5 nuclear missiles." But that's all that it took. The Department of Defense has admitted that over 1,152 moderately serious false alarms occurred between 1977 and 1984. That's roughly 3 false alarms a week. Next, we should maintain the Iran nuclear deal. This is a simple one. The deal keeps Iran under international inspections. In fact, they're the toughest inspection regimes ever instituted, and ensures that they don't get a nuclear weapon. Why would we pull out of that agreement? If we have problems with Iran, we should build on the progress that has already been made and build up a diplomatic relationship with them. That's how diplomacy works. That's how we avoided nuclear catastrophe during the Cold War. Like Reagan said, we don't have the luxury of just negotiating with our friends. Next, we should consider freezing current and planned military maneuvers with the Republic of Korea and immediately reducing tensions with North Korea. This right now is the most serious threat facing us in terms of miscalculation between nuclear-armed states. You have 2 very bombastic, cavalier, and untested leaders threatening each other with nuclear fire and fury. That's almost unheard of in modern history. We've never heard a president speak like that before. There were reports last month of North Korean intermediaries reaching out to a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. about how they should consider President Trump's tweets. That's crazy. This situation must calm down. And perhaps the best way to do it would be for the United States, the country with thousands of nuclear weapons, not just about 20 or 30 of them, to temporarily halt things like practice bombing runs on North Korea. Again, it doesn't cost us that much, and it could save the lives of millions. And finally, just as there is people trying to build more nuclear weapons out there, there are also those trying to reduce them. There are very active networks of people who have made this their mission, groups like BPAC, like Plowshares Fund, like the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, Global Zero, the Union of Concerned Scientists, the Council for a Livable World, and the Arms Control Association. All of them are working on this issue around the world every single day. And they need support. And whether that's monetarily or voluntarily, they need both. Most of all, stay informed. Please check out our website. Look at David's call to action. Call your senators and stay up to date on these issues. So thank you so much. It's been my pleasure to be here and talk to you. And I think we have plenty of time left for questions.
Jeff, I'm thrilled we prevailed on you to come to Bloomington. Thank you so much for taking time from your very busy schedule to do so. As Jeff was going through this truly harrowing set of circumstances that we face, I was reflecting on the great Yale psychiatrist and psychologist Robert J. Lifton, who wrote the great study of the Nazi doctors and a number of other books. And Lifton describes our challenge fundamentally as being to imagine the real. Just think about that for a minute. Tonight, you have been challenged to imagine the real. The real is not the parking lot at Kroger, which is sort of a pseudo-normality that we see. The reality is what Jeff has superposed on that as the threats to all of us. And the second reality is the energy, the imagination, and the hope that you can bring to end the arms race. Now, at the back of the room, our wonderful secretary and co-conspirator in cyber matters, David Orr and Nate Rosenblum, are standing. They have two very important missions tonight. The first involves wicker baskets, and we do rely on financial support. We are not a grantee of any foundation. We rely on all of you, and then we very much profit from the research that the grantees of things like the Plowshares. So if you have already contributed, thank you. If you can contribute tonight financially, if you can contribute with your time, thank you. And speaking of time, and in there will be a cookies and fruit juice reception in Fellowship Hall, and at that time you will see our two wonderful David and Nate standing, intercepting the cookie line with sign-up material. So if you aren't on our mailing list, either don't get in the cookie line or beware. So now we are going to take your questions. And we have a great resource here. And if you would please go to one of the microphones on either side and line up. And here's the procedure. As I told you, Senator Donnelly's wonderful aide for military matters, Rachel Hoven Lipsey, sent me quite a long letter. And some of us were concerned that the letter was too long and people would lose attention. And others of us felt very passionately that we had a moral and political responsibility to read the letter in full. And especially, I want you to know that Rachel came to this building, to the library upstairs, and sat with a group of 10 of us while the Iran deal was under discussion in Congress and listened to our concerns, and we were one of the first calls that Rachel made to announce that Senator Donnelly was going to support the nuclear deal. So we do very much owe it to Rachel to hear what she has to say and think carefully about it and respond.
You have been listening to Nuclear Dangers on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to Jeff Wilson of the Plowshares Fund in Washington, D.C., speak about the Trump administration's planned $1 trillion nuclear weapons escalation and the growing risk of war with North Korea and Iran. This is the second half of the talk. If you'd like to go back and hear the beginning, it is the second half of our last episode. We now return to the show, with a letter presenting an alternative perspective on the issue of nuclear danger.
Now, everybody, here is a challenge to you. They think you won't pay attention, you won't be analytical, and you'll get lost. But we think you will pay attention, and you will analyze this, we'll appreciate Rachel for her substantive answer, but we'll also see where we can continue to nudge Senator Donnelly. So here is Rachel's letter, which we asked her to write. David, thank you for giving me an opportunity to share an update on the Senator's work, that is Senator Donnelly's work, on issues related to nuclear deterrence and nuclear nonproliferation. The forum you are hosting with Mr. Wilson is certainly timely. As you may know, Senator Donnelly is the lead Democrat on two Senate panels that are dealing heavily with nuclear issues these days. The first is the Banking Subcommittee on National Security and International Trade and Finance, which oversees, among other things, U.S. sanctions policy. Sanctions, Rachel writes, are a powerful diplomatic tool to achieve our nonproliferation goals, as we saw with Iran and hope to see with North Korea. The second panel Senator Donnelly co-chairs is the Armed Services Committee Subcommittee on Strategic Forces, which oversees our nation's nuclear weapons, missile defense systems, and, critically, nuclear nonproliferation programs operated through the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy. I will just highlight what Rachel said there. We here in Bloomington, Indiana, have one of the two or three senators who has the most say on nuclear policy. So your letter to Senator Donnelly on nuclear issues could have a real impact on the nuclear policy of this nation and the world. Rachel continues, through his work on the banking panel, Senator Donnelly has been working on a bipartisan basis to emphasize the urgency of smart sanctions policy in the light of the escalating nuclear crisis with North Korea. The senator has been in dozens of meetings, briefings, and hearings on the North Korean nuclear threat. He visited South Korea and China in 2015 to talk about diplomatic options with U.S. officials and foreign leaders in the region. And he has been briefed on U.S. military options in relation to North Korea. Having joined the senator in many of these engagements, I can tell you the statement there is no good military option to resolving the North Korean threat is an understatement, in my opinion. Secretary Mattis once said that war with North Korea would be catastrophic, and I trust his judgment in this matter. In addition to the likelihood of heavy civilian casualties, I often note we have more than 20,000 U.S. service members stationed in South Korea, roughly 40,000 in Japan, another 4,000 in Guam, and another 5,000 aboard each aircraft carrier deployed in the region. Those service members are putting their lives on the line every day. And in a time of war, hundreds of thousands more would be put in harm's way. While I do believe that all options must be on the table, it is hard to overstate the gravity of the toll of a military conflict, both on the region and on the U.S. itself. Senator Donnelly has worked with both Republican and Democratic colleagues to press for stronger sanctions on North Korea and for better, smarter enforcement of those sanctions. Given the conflicting messages coming out of various elements of the administration on how best to tackle this threat, Senator Donnelly has repeatedly called on the administration to deliver to Congress a comprehensive strategy on North Korea. Because of the lack of response, the senator authored and successfully passed an amendment to this year's defense bill that requires the administration to deliver that strategy within 90 days of the bill's final passage. This work on North Korea is informed, in part, by the effectiveness of Iran's sanctions in bringing multiple international partners to the table to negotiate the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. As you know, Senator Donnelly voted in support of the deal. And as I told you earlier, Rachel, I believe, played a key role. Rachel is one of the most brilliant aides on Capitol Hill and plays a key role on the Armed Services Committee. And we are very fortunate to have her as Senator Donnelly's aide. And I believe the senator is very fortunate to have her. The administration is required by law under the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act to inform Congress within 10 days of learning of a potential breach of the agreement by Iran. Congress has received no such notification, and leaders from the Defense Department have testified to the senator and others that they are not aware of any material breach. The agreement has rolled back Iran's nuclear program and opened Iran up to the most intensive nuclear inspections regime in history. Secretary Mattis testified to us just this week that he believes it is in the national security interest of the United States to remain in the JCPOA. There is no question, Rachel continues, that the Iranian government supports terrorist groups, egregiously violates the human rights of its own people, and continues to develop and test ballistic missiles that pose a serious concern to the U.S. and our allies in the Middle East and Europe. Building on the success of the JCPOA in stopping Iran's development of a nuclear warhead, we should apply the same level of U.S. and international effort to addressing these other destabilizing activities. One issue we have dealt with throughout both the North Korean and Iranian proliferation crisis is the potential for other countries to develop their own weapons in response to what they perceive as an escalating nuclear threat in the region. And then she continues, quote, "One of the best tools we have to combat nuclear non-proliferation is the strength of our own nuclear deterrent and the nuclear umbrella we cast over our allies to provide them with the assurance they need to avoid developing their own weapons programs. As long as there are nuclear weapons in the world and the threat of further proliferation among our adversaries and friends alike, the U.S. should maintain a strong nuclear deterrent. That is the focus of the senator's work on the Armed Services Committee." And she continues, "The multiple modernization programs going on right now across the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy are necessary to maintain the safety, security, and effectiveness of our deterrent. The senator does support the broad goal of modernizing the deterrent, but smart, well-intentioned people disagree on specific programs. The senator has and will continue to hear and keep an open door to conflicting views from experts, advocates, and, perhaps most importantly, constituents. The senator has publicly questioned Pentagon leaders on how the nation will manage the significant projected cost of these programs and will continue to make that a priority in his leadership of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee. We have worked with groups like the Arms Control Association and Union of Concerned Scientists on our oversight efforts. The Senator has also put forward cost-saving proposals of his own, like increased commonality across his services, i.e., we taxpayers shouldn't be paying to reinvent the wheel every time the Air Force or the Navy wants a new missile. There are common elements that can and should be used across the services, and the services should be collaborating far more on their various modernization efforts to minimize duplicative efforts and wasteful spending. Finally, David, I know you were in attendance when at the event, Senator Donnelly organized with IU, recognizing the 25th anniversary of the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program. Nunn-Lugar and other similar efforts in the Defense and Energy Departments are top priorities for the Senator in his leadership of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee. He has fended off attacks on the funding of these programs, passed legislation to ensure Nunn-Lugar remains flexible and relevant as global dynamics change, and even traveled to Eastern Europe to witness firsthand the results of our collaboration on non-proliferation with countries like Ukraine and Georgia. We are working to bring more of our colleagues on board this effort, and I would love to work with you and your fellow advocates on that in the coming months. Thank you for your engagement and advocacy on these important issues. Very respectfully, Rachel Hoven Lipsey, Military Legislative Assistant to Senator Joe Donnelly. Again, we have copies of Rachel's letter, so you can study it in detail. We are very grateful to her for having written such a substantive statement. In the printout, you will also find our own response in full. I won't read that out loud, but I will say we stress several things. We ask Senator Donnelly to support negotiations with North Korea. We ask him to oppose snapback sanctions with Iran. We hope he'll oppose the destabilizing weapons systems Jeff has discussed, and we urge him to support Senator Markey's bill requiring the President to obtain congressional authorization before launching a nuclear first strike. I hope you'll contact Senator Donnelly as well as Senator Young and Representative Hollingsworth. Together, we can and will delegitimize these indefensible weapons and work toward their global elimination. Now, let's get back to the Q&A. Millie, come back up.
So given the vulnerabilities that exist with nuclear power plants, and to my knowledge, we have really no effective and safe way to store nuclear waste, so taking current nuclear weapons out of circulation, so to speak, are we really, I mean, we're creating other problems in terms of what to do with that, the nuclear components of that, and it wouldn't take a nuclear bomb to trigger a devastating nuclear disaster because of the existence and vulnerabilities of nuclear power plants. So I'm just wondering, it just seems like we would create, we're not really solving, am I making sense? I'm not really sure how to articulate that, but.
Absolutely. So Plowshares does not work on nuclear power, but from the what I can tell you about it is a couple of interesting things. Nuclear power disasters are incredibly frightening prospect. They're very dangerous. They have the possibility of contaminating large swaths of country with radioactive fallout. The interesting thing is that you can walk into Fukushima province today and receive less radioactivity than you do flying on a 747 at a couple thousand feet. Chernobyl continued to produce power through the 90s. They are terrible disasters, but they pale in comparison to a nuclear weapon detonating. I know it's a little bit like apples and oranges. When you have so many terrible possibilities, it's hard to compare the two. And yes, nuclear waste storage is a real problem in this country. We have a legacy of, a Cold War legacy of massive amounts of nuclear waste that was improperly stored and buried. It's in landfills all over the country. It's in Superfund sites. A lot of nuclear power plants, all nuclear power plants right now, store their spent fuel in pools sitting outside the power plants. That's why I'm 5 inches taller than the rest of my family, I think. There are problems. Just like anything else, there are serious problems with resolving any serious national security issue. But those problems are significantly less than some of the problems that we showed, of having a weapon be ejected 100 feet into the air, of missiles catching on fire. Those, to me, are much, much more dire threats. But that's just my opinion on it. I hope that answers your question, though. Sir.
Thank you for coming. Thanks for organizing this really burning issue, David. There are lots of things I'd like to talk about, I think, and I'm not going to talk about them. I do want to just mention that any talk of American foreign policy that doesn't address the issue of empire, that constantly rallies around the flag and defers so much to our soldiers who are defending all the dear principles, and they're not. They're defending empire primarily. And the reason they're in the army oftentimes is because of enormous economic inequality. Having said that, I want to address what I think is a basic issue which I haven't heard mentioned. We're arguing from not an ethical principle at all, unless we're totally bereft of a sense of morality, which is the principle we're arguing from here is rational self-interest. I don't want to be disdainful of that, but it's not the fundamental principle that guides most of our lives, or are we exhorted to that. Our foreign policy has as its first arsenal, practically, our first tool, weapons which don't pass any critical analysis in terms of their ethical status. It used to be, and I'm nostalgic for the time when people talked about principles of just war, principles of legitimate self-defense, where there was a fundamental prejudice against killing, and certainly killing innocent people. But even your enemy, even the aggressor, in the tradition that this culture, I assume, was pretty much built on, could not directly will the harm or killing of another person. Killing was permissible only under self-defense. We no longer even think in those terms. Killing is wanton, and a good part of our tax money, we're asked to support immoral, military, imperial work, and we keep on ice the rage of this, what I call Luciferian attitude of, I'm going to assert my will, the devil take the hindmost, if it means all of humanity goes up in smoke. We keep that ready, as you said, on trigger ready. I think a very practical issue here is revitalize the moral issues of our paying taxes, and certainly our representatives supporting this deterrence. We're not going to lower our nuclear weapon supply. We're not going to do that unless other people do it. We are justifying horrible, horrible, unjustifiable means for allegedly superior, laudable ends. The whole means and relationship here is incommensurate, and we have to bring that out. We cannot destroy humanity for anything, but we can't even destroy another human being willingly unless we return to those kind of principles. And I'm exhorting us all, and I'm certainly as much of a coward as anybody, to think about the Fellowship of Reconciliation. I'm not sure it exists anymore, but there was a tax movement, and they used to take it out some aspect of your income tax. But we are all guilty of genocide, ecocide, homicide in terms of the species by paying into this war machine and denying and lying to ourselves that this is a name of the flag or the motherhood or justice. Or there are a lot of bastards out there. We know that. But we are that. We are they. We are the enemy. We support this, and we have to face our complicity in all this.
I completely understand. As a response, I would say that I agree with a lot of that you have to say. I also disagree with some of it. I think that all we have to do is look at this Nobel Peace Prize that was just awarded. This is a campaign that over 127 nations signed on to, saying that the humanitarian cost, the humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons is unacceptable and absolutely immoral. So I don't believe that people don't care about this. And I don't believe that all Americans don't care about it either. I think that this idea of patriotism has gotten wrapped up in this sort of chest-thumping, militaristic, perhaps even jingoistic sort of way. I don't think that that means that all people that join the military are that way. I certainly don't. I have to disagree here. I think that there are a lot of Americans out there that do want to serve their country. It is not up to them to decide where their government sends them. The people that decide that, we put into power. All of us in this room. This is still a representative democracy. I believe that 100%. It doesn't work the way that we hope it would all the time. But at the end of the day, we are still responsible. So I understand the frustration and I understand the contempt for what our leaders do. But we have to work harder. And that's why all of us, I hope, are here today to learn more about something that impacts every human being on this planet. These are unethical weapons. You're 100% right about that. We should not support them. We should work as hard as we can to remove them from this planet. And there are a lot of good people, all these folks up here in this picture, some of the best and brightest people that I have ever met in my life. Some of them are veterans. Some of them are public servants, all working towards that end. And they all bring their individuality and their shared experience together to work towards this. I'm not sure if that answers everything that you brought up, but that is how I feel. But thank you. Thank you for sharing.
You've been listening to Jeff Wilson of the Plowshares Fund in Washington, D.C., speak about the Trump administration's planned $1 trillion nuclear weapons escalation and the growing risk of war with North Korea and Iran. This is the second half of the talk. If you'd like to go back and hear the beginning, it is the second half of our last episode.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.